Well, good morning, Erin.
Good morning, Justin.
I'm here with Erin from Les Mills. Erin Kelly, how are things on the East Coast?
Things are going quite well. We're continuing to grow and grow and grow, which is a good thing.
Well, that's why I want to talk to you.
Yeah, exactly. So, given the economy over the past few years and the product that we sell, we're definitely in a good space. So that's good news.
Good. So, what's your official title at Les Mills?
My official title is Executive Vice President of Les Mills East Coast.
Okay, excellent. So let's start with who is Les Mills?
Well, who is Les Mills? He is an actual person. That's the question we always get.
Yeah.
But he's an actual person that lives in New Zealand. So that's where the company was founded, was in Auckland, New Zealand. Les Mills started as a group of health clubs in New Zealand. So there's 10 locations currently in New Zealand. And from
I
that,
trained once at the Auckland one.
oh, really?
It's cavernous.
Yes, it is.
And it's a real buzz training there because there must have been like 1,000 other people in the premises as a whole.
Yeah, it does really, really well. And that's kind of by exception to the fact that the facility itself isn't a wow. I mean, when you first walk in, it's been a pretty old building and, not a what you would consider really sort of high-end looking
No.
health club facility by any stretch, but they do significantly well. And I guess back in the late 70s, early 80s, Philip Mills, who's actually the son of Les Mills, went to school at UCLA in California. And while he was there, he saw Jazzercise. And when he saw the Jazzercise program, he thought, wow, this is something we should take back and use in our clubs in New Zealand. So he went back, talked to us, and I'm giving a very condensed Reader's Digest version. But long story short, they developed a pre-choreographed program called Body Pump. And based on the Jazzercise sort of background and structure and ideas around it. And then from there it grew. So it was offered in their own clubs and then it branched into Australia, which is our leading country from a market penetration standpoint. And there it branched out globally from there. So it started with Body Pump, which is one of our group exercise to music programs. Now we have 10 programs in the group fitness space. We just launched a small group training program. We're getting ready to launch into virtual and kids programming as well. So we're pretty expansive a fitness organization, I guess you'd say that we've branched out from we used to be just group exercise programming, and now we're quite a bit more than that.
And I think it's safe to say you're definitely the world leader in group fitness.
Yes, we're definitely the world leader in group fitness. So we're in over, well, we just hit over 16,000 locations globally. Hundreds of thousands of instructors that are teaching our programs around the world. And here in the US, we're in about 3,000 facilities, over 3,000. And on the East Coast specifically, we have probably over between 10 and 15,000 instructors that are teaching our programs on the East Coast. So it's becoming a pretty expansive network of instructors and facilities that are offering our programming currently.
Okay, and I'm from Australia, as you know. So in Australia, Les Mills is absolutely a household name. In fact, it's not possible, I don't think, to go to a gym and not find Les Mills classes.
Yes, that's accurate.
You'd have to go to significant effort.
It's kind of like they've gotten to the point there where it's like having a treadmill in your club. I mean, you have to have it in order to compete in the marketplace. We're not quite there yet on in the US. The US was the last country to come on board in comparison to the rest of the world. But we're definitely beginning to make our mark, and it's getting to that tipping point slowly but surely. But it's interesting in the US market because we're not at that point yet where we're a must-have, we're a nice to have. And clubs that use us oftentimes find great success with us, but it's something like they can still operate their business without us.
And you have competitors now, of course.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So you've got Zumba in.
We do.
They have just the one or one or two groups?
They actually have a suite of programs themselves now
Okay.
in a bunch of different categories. And they're definitely one of our top competitors. Freestyle is probably still our number one competitor in the US. Clubs, doing their own programming, instructors teaching their own types of classes.
Were you an instructor once?
Yes, that's where I
Yeah.
started. That's where it all began back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So,
I taught aerobics in the 80s.
It's where
Yeah.
leg warmers.
What's that?
Were you wearing your leg warmers?
Probably. I don't know if I wore them or not, but I had them, so I could probably be I was probably guilty.
Yeah, probably shorts that were way too short.
I don't want to go that far. So now I shouldn't Les Mills is a huge organization. I want to say the size. I want to say more than 100 million in sales worldwide, just to make it clear the magnitude of the success. And considering that Les Mills came from Auckland and has spread to the whole world, now you're teaching the Californians how to exercise.
Yes, it's true.
It's really pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
But I want to zero in now and talk about the work that we did with you and also the work that you've continued to do on the East Coast there. Can we start by describing what things were like before you worked with us? And then we can talk a little bit about the strategy that we came up with. We ran a 2-day workshop, I remember, in San Francisco. So let's start with the before.
Well, the before was we were a pretty traditional sales environment. So it was geographically based. So we had a team of salespeople. And when we started, I mean, if you take before the East Coast was divided into three regions. So we had a Northeast division, Mid-Atlantic division, and a Southeast division. And between all three divisions, we had well over at certain time periods between probably 8 to 15 people, outside salespeople. In a sort of traditional lone wolf sort of scenario, where they, had a territory, they did all their own prospecting, they did all of their own appointment setting, they arranged their own schedules, and then also did all the follow-up work, were responsible for theoretically putting all that information into our CRM system, so it was, and we really found minimal success in that scenario. So it was always a struggle to really hit any sort of minimums from a sales production standpoint.
But you were still making sales.
Yeah, and I think for, well, we were making sales, but just not in a really impactful way given the size of the market. So, and part of that, I'm sure, was a combination of market awareness of us, because when we first came across, we've had been regionalized now for about 8 years, was that the awareness of Les Mills was pretty minimal. And that's shifted quite a bit over the last few years, definitely. But that played into a component of it. But it was largely more around the system that we were operating in, that just we couldn't get any scale out of it. And for me, from a management perspective, there was zero visibility. And that was the hardest thing for me, was
In
that,
spite of the CRM.
because nothing was actually being entered into the CRM on any sort of regularity. So it was, no way to really get accurate reporting out of it. It's just very, very challenging to manage. Very challenging to manage those people. You just sort of crossed your fingers and hope that they were doing what you asked them to do, and having that trust that everyone's out there doing what they need to do and giving 100% of their effort. So it was a challenge. We went through quite a few people, that just didn't actually work out for us, and to kind of go through those growing pains, I think, over time. But so that's where we were. That was pre you.
Great. So it was a while back now, the 2-day workshop in San Francisco. It was a fun, noisy 2 days. But I'm wondering if between us, you and I can piece together what we discussed in the workshop and what the main conclusions were coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, we went through our current process and then looking at how we could, basically divide labor across the sales engine and get more scalability across of it, get more visibility and overall more productivity out of the team, and was, I guess, the end goal. So as we went through that exercise, I was looking at the different streams of work and who would be responsible for each of those streams, and pulling away the parts that traditionally good outside salespeople are not typically, there are always exceptions, but are not great at details or not great at all those things that we sort of pile onto them that really doesn't sit with their skill set.
So I'm pretty sure I would argue that gosh, well, there's a whole bunch of stuff we could do here on the telephone. We don't really have to have field-based people doing all of these activities.
Correct. Yes.
So what did we decide to bring inside?
So we brought in prospecting. We brought in appointment setting. We brought in all of the administrative work that sits around the process. And then we also put a system around creating environments where we would, more educational environments to use them as prospecting tools. So we did luncheons that we would set up for prospects. And that worked quite well for us. So we were able to speak to a room full of people versus trying to, meet with people on an individual basis.
Yeah. So I think bringing a division of labor was one of the big ideas, but the other big idea was to really leverage events.
Yes.
Because I think you guys had been running events and having success with them, but from memory, events weren't really tightly integrated into the standard sales model.
Yeah, what we were finding with the events that we were running was we would basically get the non-decision makers there. So it was those that were more influencers than true decision makers. And in our world, when you're looking at, the traditional sort of health club environment, that would be group fitness directors and so on, and versus us having owners and managers there in front of us to have those business discussions with that are the ultimate decision makers in our process.
But you were in a situation where you knew how to run events, you were confident you could put people in a room, and you'd had success with events perhaps in different areas, maybe not selling clubs. So we decided to make events the center point of the sales environment. And we also talked about the positioning of Les Mills, because unfortunately you're not in a situation that you are in Australia, or even perhaps France to some extent, I think, from memory, where you can say, well, we're Les Mills.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can't do that. And like I said, we're a nice to have, but at the same time, it's a lot of education around what we actually bring to the table, because there isn't a big awareness around the full picture of what happens when we partner with a club. So it's kind of, we have the reputation of being Body Pump, which is, our most well-known program, but now we have this suite of programming and suite of business offerings that sit around that. So that was really the message that we wanted to bring.
And it's more than just the programs. You actually will find and train the instructors too.
Yes.
So you maintain a network of instructors in addition to the network of clubs.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Okay. So it's education for instructors, education from the business side. We supply all the marketing and support around the programs as well. So it's a kind of all-encompassing support system that we have in place when a facility takes on our programming.
So we talked about the approach to the market, or the story that you would approach the market with, the proposition. Do you remember what we concluded where that was concerned?
Yeah, we decided to put together an educational series around membership growth and profit and how to really drive that, leading more with the insights around some of the things that maybe club owners and operators aren't so aware of, but then at the end, tying in the piece of what we bring to the table that can help with driving that overall profitability and revenue, which is member engagement and member motivation, and how we tied all those together. So it was really interesting, because as we started going through that process, and owners and managers were coming to these sessions, that was definitely the end result that we were getting out of it was, wow, I didn't really put those pieces together. Just around, for an example, when a member joins a club, and if they're not engaged within the first 30 days, you're losing them out of the bottom almost immediately. So there has to be some engagement plan in place to get that.
So I remember what we were hoping for, and it was sort of a fairly audacious challenge. So I'll let you talk about how far you've come with it. But I remember what we were hoping for in the workshop was to get to the point where you could present a methodology for improving the profitability of a club in such a way that group fitness had an essential role to play. How far did you get with that?
We actually got quite far. The the lead in, the tie-in at the end of that session was around how to leverage group fitness to be one of the biggest tools in the toolbox around how you drive member engagement. And overall, if members are engaged, they're staying longer, which is driving overall profitability for a club. And one of the easiest things they can do if they're doing it well. So that's really what we were trying to bring to the table was, you know, how to lift the game in the group exercise space to get a better result, which leads to overall increase in member profitability. And, you know, I think we connected those dots pretty well. And we had, you know, actually surprisingly, I guess it was surprising because we hadn't done it before, but we were, you know, actually having really good attendance across the sessions.
And so let's come back to the results in a second. I just want to, I want to lead you on a bit of a tangent here, because one thing that I've always found curious is how clubs are structured. And I'm keen to hear your input on it, from your personal opinion and also from your vantage point at Les Mills. When you look at clubs, what you seem to be seeing is they're almost businesses, they run like businesses within businesses, because you have the club operator who provides the real estate and all the equipment. But then you have group fitness running almost as if it's its own little self-contained enterprise. And then you have personal training running as if it's its own little self-contained enterprise. And I suspect in some clubs, you might have racquetball and swim and other things that are run similarly. Am I observing reality correctly? And what's your opinion about that?
Yes, the observation is absolutely correct in many instances. And that it's a bit of a, it is interesting because they do almost operate in silos from one another. So versus seeing the synergistic opportunity between, you know, the different departments is that they do sort of operate as their own islands. And oftentimes it's because I think of what the actual tangible pieces that each of those departments bring to the table. So, you know, from the actual sort of generic pieces of the club that operate from a cardio and equipment standpoint, it's that's really looking at it from the membership perspective. You know, how's overall membership being driven through the doors and what are those results? Personal training does the same. So there's an actual real revenue component to that that gets treated in isolation sometimes. But, you know, in many clubs, it is intertwined into the membership piece, more so now than ever. And then from the group fitness standpoint, you know, they're a little bit lower oftentimes on the priority list because there isn't a real tangible revenue dollar that is seen, that's realized from that department on a monthly basis. Mm. So it's more seen as a cost center versus a revenue generating opportunity within a club. And just oftentimes it's something that club owners and operators, they know they need to have it, but they don't really optimize it in a way that they connect the dots of how that's one affecting retention and how to use it as an overall acquisition tool. So there definitely is, you know, your observation is correct that it's oftentimes operated very in a very segmented way.
And so are there any club owners that have decided to manage the club as a whole and have found a method to optimize the club as a whole rather than optimizing the parts in isolation? And what are the implications of that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess case in point, which is the easiest reference to make, are the Les Mills clubs down in Auckland. So a huge part of that onboarding system when new members join is they're automatically brought into group fitness as part of that initial onboarding experience based on their goals and objectives of why they joined the club to begin with. So it's part of the, like I said, the initial onboarding experience, and a schedule is built out for them for 30 days around these are the classes that you're going to take, in addition to introducing them to other parts of the club as well. So they still get time with the trainer, they still get introduced to those pieces also. But, you know, I mean, their retention is amazing. And I think from a usage standpoint, from recollection, it's upward about 60% of, you know, all active members are participating in group fitness, which is huge. I mean, the average in the U.S., even our best multi-purpose facilities, you know, the benchmark is around 30%. So they double that, you know, and their revenues per member definitely show how that's benefiting their business. I mean, they make $10,000 to $15,000 a month just in spinning bike reservations. You know,
Wow.
that's not even, that's just to say, hey, I want to make sure I have a seat in the class. Then above anything else, on top of membership. So multiply that times, you know, over the course of time. So they're, that's an easy example to use. As far as from a US-based example, you know, we're definitely seeing more and more facilities that are.
So for years I've felt, and over the years I've lectured on a number of occasions to the industry, and I've been close friends with Jamie Hayes in Australia there for many, many years, and I feel like there's a story there to be told. Are you and it's almost a par well, it's definitely a paradigm shift. Are you guys getting to tell that story?
Yes, I think so. And like we're seeing more and more facilities realizing, you know, connecting the opportunities between those departments and the synergies that can be realized between them is kind of an exponential in what the results breed. You know, we have one in Pennsylvania, for example, Universal Athletic Club. They are probably one of the best clubs in the country in how they onboard their members, how they integrate them into group fitness, PT, small group training. It's they're not operating as independent islands within their club. And that's all, and it really starts with the onboarding process. And the more that club owners and operators can wrap their head around engaging members once they join in those key areas right in the first 30 days and not really leaving it up to them to make choices, because you know, the bottom line is that most members are, they don't know what they don't know, you know, so it's, they need to be guided in that way. So I think we're seeing, we're able to tell that story more because of the way we've set up our systems now, but, and we're seeing more and more facilities start to embrace that, which is
Great.
great
So
to
let's
see.
come back to your sales function. Tell me about what it looks like now and highlight the differences.
Yeah, quite a difference. So we our first transition, we sort of toe dipped into the ballistic system because versus sort of ripping the Band-Aid off at one time. And so we started with our top performer because I knew that if I could get her to buy into the system, embrace it, and ultimately it helps her to perform even at a higher level, then I knew that would be much easier to implement across the board. So the first step we did was to pull, we basically did a one-to-one ratio of an inside-outside model on the East Coast. At the time, we had, so we consolidated, you know, I said at any point in time, we had, you know, 8 to 15 people that were operating as independent salespeople out there in the field on their own, is that we pared that down. At one point, and we consolidated between the regions, so we had 4 inside people and 4 outside people. At one time, we had 5 and 5, and then we brought it down even more. So we keep reducing it down. So we reduced it down about 20% to 4 and 4, and then as of January, we're actually reducing it down again to 3, 3 and 3. I'm sorry, 4 and 3. So we're actually going to experiment with 2 inside to 1 outside. To drive hopefully even more productivity for that outside person across a larger territory. So that shift began, I guess, in October of 2011. And then in January of 12, we shifted the entire team over. So that was the first change, was just structurally the inside-outside model. But then from a compensation standpoint, you know, it was a pretty drastic change for us, was, you know, removing commission completely. So we put everyone on straight salary, you know, and adjusted them accordingly. And you know, it's interesting that even though we've shifted from that, you know, productivity has definitely not suffered. It's actually improved. Sales performance has improved overall. Sales revenue is up. Costs are down from an overhead perspective. So, you know, all those things point us in the right direction that it's working for us.
So you've gone from a team of about 10 field-based people to you're planning on having a team of just a couple of field-based people. You've built an inside sales team. Can you talk about what the and costs have come down, obviously, but sales have gone up. I mean, to some people, that's going to be almost unbelievable, especially when you throw into the mix that you got rid of sales commissions. Maybe you should explain as best you can why that has happened. How is it possible to reduce the size of the field team so significantly and have and get rid of commissions and have sales go up?
I mean, I think it's just from my vantage point is that we took away all of those things from the outside team that were restricting performance. So all of the things that we were asking them to do that really didn't help to move any new business forward, you know, putting information into CRM and writing proposals and sales agreements and all of the appointment setting and prospecting, was that what they do best is to sit on the other side of the table from someone and have, you know, a business consultant conversation. So we were really limiting how much of that they could actually do because of all of the other things we were asking them to do in addition to it. And we actually, quite frankly, weren't doing quite well. So once we extracted that out of their day-to-day workload, it freed them to do what they do best, which is really sit in that consultant space. You know, I think that's why that's proven more successful for us, because they're able to do more of what they're really good at.
So the salespeople you've retained, would they prefer working in the model now to working in the model previously?
Yeah, they love it now. They love it. So, I mean, for them, I mean, they say oftentimes, we could never go back, never ever go back
That's a good
to,
sign.
yeah, it's a really good sign. And
And are they earning less or more?
I mean, they're earning more from a consistent standpoint
Yeah.
across the board. And it was interesting once we removed that commission piece, which I thought was going to be the most challenging. Because I have a couple people that came from a real true sort of sales commission environment. You know, if you talk about if someone that came from health club sales, really, really highly incentivized for the most part by commissions. And it's all about targets and commission tiers and all those sorts of things. And, you know, that's his mentality. So I thought he's going to have a really hard time with this. But once we transitioned to the model, he said, you know, it's actually nice because I can just relax. I can relax and do what I do well, because actually you have to have the right people in there that no matter whether they're, because commission at the end of the day really wasn't acting as an incentivizer. It was acting as a pressure, you know, top down around performance, which almost sometimes, and I guess all the research points to that, is that it actually restricts performance actually than increasing it. So
Yeah.
it allowed them to relax and again do what they do best. You know, and at the end of the day, they're still evaluated on their performance and what they're bringing to the table, but it's not that.
It's not piece rate pay anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
So, can you tell us about the role of events, both physical events and webinars, in the whole sales model?
Yeah, so we started with doing quite a few regional events, and we called them the membership growth luncheons,
Yeah.
and
Hey, I would love to link our viewers to that original membership growth luncheon little microsite
yeah.
with you guys spruiking. Does that still exist?
I believe it does, yes.
Is it
Yes.
membershipgrowthluncheon.com?
Think so, yes.
Okay.
So that's where we started. And that, like I said, we had good attendance at the events. And for us, what I guess for me, what I realized after we went through that is we did have to tweak the message a little bit more. So we gave them a lot of great information and why partnering with us would help them to really leverage the information we were giving them. But it didn't quite point us in the, you know, kind of land in, well, you could only do it with us.
Hmm.
That's the only way you're going to get these results is if you partner with us. So we're looking to tweak that a little bit more so that the message actually lands more from a challenger sales perspective around we're leading them down the journey. And at the end of the journey, it's we're the solution and the only way they can actually get there, which that's, I think, where we just need to tweak it a
But
little
you're
bit.
definitely not, you weren't in the past, and I'm guessing you're not in the future, running events saying, come and learn about being a Les Mills group fitness club.
Oh no.
You're leading with something that's bigger than what you offer still.
So we're really focused on leading with insights insights around the industry, insights on the research that we continue to bring to the table. And that's been our directive around with our initial launch. We've had a few other innovations that have come out over the past year and a half that have given us, something different to talk about also. So with small group training, that was a real opportunity for us to do an East Coast tour, and that was an event tour. We've ran it twice now, in the fall and in the spring, around really bringing some insights around how to run effective small group training and what are the keys in order to make that successful. So we've had a couple different streams of opportunities to do something around the education space and event
So
driven.
what number of events are you running now? What sort of people are you putting through them? The mix of physical and webinar, and also what percentage of sales opportunities are coming from events?
Yeah, I probably should have those numbers for you. As far as probably the average attendance for events, we're bringing in roughly, if we're doing live events in person, roughly, I think the average is around 15 to 20 people per event. But these are all decision makers that are coming from these locations, which is who we need to have there. From a webinar perspective, that sort of runs the gamut. So sometimes we'll have 10 to 15 people on a webinar. We just had one 2 weeks ago that had 60 people registered for it. So it just really depends. A lot of it's timing and when we're out there, but we'll definitely get a good share rate on those as well.
And the percentage of opportunities that are coming from events?
Probably 50%, out of the events are turning into real opportunities that we're moving forward, which is a pretty good conversion rate on events.
Yeah. So, and your inside people push will hustle people into events?
Yes. So when we're running events, it gives them a reason to call people and invite them, and versus, cold calling.
And it's time sensitive. The great thing about events is, I have to talk to you now because the event's in 2 days' time.
Yes. We've seen a really good response from them, and it just helps us to drive overall business opportunities, but also brand awareness in markets also. So that's been.
And the utilization of the salespeople, can you comment on how many you mentioned before they're most effective when they're sitting face to face with decision makers. Do you have a feel for how many times that's happening today on a per salesperson basis than was happening previously?
Yes. So our targeting, we target right now 10 to 15 appointments per week, and that is not just face to face, but it could be face to face virtually as well. So we're looking at roughly 30 to 40 appointments or more per month that we're running through the outside sales team. And so that's way, way more than we were ever doing before. I mean, it was,
In total.
yes.
So even with it's more than you were doing before with up to 10 people in the field.
Yes. So it's been a dramatic shift, and definitely one that's reaped great benefit for us. Like I said, we've decreased salespeople by January. We'll be down probably 30% from where we originally started. Even within the ballistic system, and used to tell me, you've told me since day one, you have too many outside salespeople.
I
So,
remember we argued about that a little in the 2 day workshop.
yes, and I am a believer now. So we have, and it's just opportunities have come about that we're able to shift some people around and actually make those changes, and then overall sales, and this was probably just this year on year, we're up about between 15 and 20%. So. Good.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So costs are down, sales are up.
yes
And the whole thing's probably easier to manage.
way easier to manage. It's for us, the inside outside is, it's just obviously, just with any business, you just need to find the right people and find the right people that actually click with one another as well. So that's been good. We've got a great team in place, and it's a little bit of a learning curve, for those inside folks to understand, wrap their heads around the business and the messaging and all those things. But it was a learning curve for us to get there around what is the type of person that we're looking for that really fits that role well. So I think we have that profile pretty nailed down, and yeah, so it's running well now.
That's great. Well, this is a really nice story, Erin.
Yeah.
It's a really nice story.
It's a good story for us, definitely.
And it's very scalable.
Yes,
I
it
mean,
is.
I would love to think that we could talk again in a few years' time, and you could say, "Well, we have a inside sales team in one location in the U.S., and we have 25 people in that inside sales team." Or better still, I'd love to talk to someone at Les Mills and hear that we have three or four call centers or inside sales teams in different locations in the world, and we schedule the entire world's appointments from those locations.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Because that's really where you could go.
Yeah, yes, for
We
sure.
worked with a company in Chicago once that had, I think, six different languages being spoken 24 hours, well, at different points in the clock, but they operated 24 hours a day with both a customer service team and an inside sales team.
Wow.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
And good luck with wherever this takes you next.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.